The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. Today we'll be hearing about some historical, anthropological, psychological and neurological perspectives on kissing. My guest today is Cheryl Kirschenbaum, author of the new book, The Science of Kissing. But before we get to that, there's this. I'm here with Greg Layden, evolutionary anthropologist and author of Greg Layden's blog, for another edition of Everything You Know Is Sort of Wrong. Welcome back, Greg.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well. Thanks for being here. So this time around, the falsehood that we're going to tackle is there are human universals. Now, you know I'm a sucker for defined terms. So tell us what kinds of traits that you're talking about when we refer to human universals.
The term became commonly used and the whole idea gained some traction back when a guy named Brown wrote a book called Human Universals. And he made a list of things that people have been talking about for years. Things like, we all have the same color vision. And when you look at different cultures, you see that people have vastly different sets of words and vastly different numbers of colors that they refer to. But it's actually very systematic. So every culture that has one or two colors has the same exact colors that they refer to by name. And if you add a color, it's almost always the same color that's added onto that list and so on. So that there's a kind of a universal relationship that our brains somehow have to the color spectrum so that we identify red way before we identify chartreuse as a named color. It's said to be a universal phenomenon that's found across all societies. It's an example that suggests that we have some commonality in the way our neural systems work, the way our brains work, the way we've evolved.
Also, the range of emotions experienced by people is the same.
Yeah, and that's an interesting one because that wasn't so much part of the original human universals list, but it is one that people often talk about. And to me, it's a really interesting case because, you know, we have a lot of conversations about emotions and their social and cultural underpinnings and how they're shaped. There was an argument on my blog having to do with the question of sexual jealousy. And a lot of my commenters came on and said sexual jealousy is something that you completely make up and it isn't real. Yet I think you can find strong evidence that lots of people experience sexual jealousy, but it's an emotional state in any event. We know what part of the brain operates emotions. We know that it's a limbic system and there's hormonal systems that are involved. We know that you could take a laboratory animal, as these experiments have been done many times, and you know stick little probes inside its brain and get it to express emotional states. Emotions are a mechanical part of the brain in some ways, yet they're also very much tied in with our culture and our beings, relationships to each other in our societies. We create art that induces emotions, so it's something that we can easily think of as being sort of outside of our brains or outside of our bodies in some way as well. So it becomes controversial as to whether we grow into our emotions, we learn them as a cultural trait, or whether we will have certain emotions no matter what happens. And I think it's easy to demonstrate that there are certain emotional reactions that people are always going to have. You can go up behind anybody, no matter what culture they're from, and make a loud noise, and they'll make a certain response that will be the same one every time with every single person you do it to. But there's an emotion that in some groups of people in Indonesia, for example, who have a name for this emotion is called malu, and it's a certain kind of, we would call it embarrassment. Yet if people who study it can clearly show that it is, there's a guy named Dan Fessler who wrote his thesis on this, he can show that in many ways it's a distinct emotion different from other emotions that other cultures have. So it's an existing emotion that's been culturally shaped to be distinctly different. I think that we can see emotions as a neurological hormonal process that all mammals have. They have similar parts of the brain in all mammals that carry out these functions. Different mammals have different sets of emotions, and primates have a particular subset of those emotions, and humans are pretty much like other primates at some level, but in other levels, we exploit these very powerful biological phenomena in cultural ways and social ways. And we end up by fine-tuning them. And that's what the human universal question comes in. I mean, is it really a human universal if it's something that culture changes a lot? And to me, that leads to why this is a falsehood, which is that the assumption here is often that a human universal is a thing that all humans have because we're born with it. It's a thing all humans have because evolution has shaped our genome to make sure that we develop a certain way that these things are there when we're adults or whatever. And people then contrast that in their minds, I think, with the alternative, which is that culture creates certain traits in people. And there's a false dichotomy there where, first of all, there are genetic causes and there are cultural causes as though they were distinct, which, you know, they are at some level. But most things require context and many different sources of information in order for them to function properly. But also, there's an idea that something that's genetic is going to be expressed in a similar way in every person that has those genes, whereas cultural things will vary dramatically from place to place and person to person. And the evidence is really against that. For example, most people are pretty sure that height is a genetic trait, but that's not true. The variation in height across people within a population or over time is not genetic. It has to do more with diet and other factors. There are genes that affect height, and there's a few populations with genes that make their height different than others. But for the most part, it's a biological feature that is entirely controlled by something that's not genetic. Whereas there are things that are cultural that are extremely, the classic example Sarah Hurdy pointed out, I think, was when girls menstruate for the first time, varies. It's a biological phenomenon. It varies over time and across populations by like 10 years. But when people get married, well, that varies across cultures too. But in a given culture, you'll find people holding on to their marriage systems and their age of marriage and their marriage ceremonies without changing them for decades and decades while menses changes.
Well, then where does the concept of an exception to the rule come in then?
I think some kinds of exceptions are just obviously just plain exceptions. You don't really worry about them. I mean, a person who is blind is not an exception to the potential universal of color and how we name color. A person who is colorblind is an individual exception, but it doesn't make any difference to the statement that cultures have a similar way across the entire planet of dealing with naming colors. I think a really interesting kind of exception that isn't an exception is looking at gender roles. When you look at male versus female roles, if you start with one culture, just say, you know, North American culture, and try to define a maleness versus femaleness kind of scale for any one of several different behaviors, like children on a playground. A child falls to the ground and another child goes over and kicks dirt in his face versus a child goes over and nurtures the person. That's a pretty standard, you know, ethnographic dichotomy, whether you help someone or hurt someone who is, you know, has a minor problem. And you look at these kind of scales across cultures and you'll find that there'll be people of one gender, of one sex, in one culture that are in the opposite direction. There'll be males that are more female-like than the females of another culture. But when you look within a culture, the relationships between males and females are almost always about the same. The males are more male-like and the females are more female-like within a given culture. So it's not how male-like people are or how female-like people are as an absolute value that's coded in your genes and comes out no matter what you do, but rather people are extremely variable in how they can be in terms of gender roles. And in a typical society, there's a typical relationship between typical males and typical females that results in a certain dichotomy in certain areas. When it comes to nurturing of children, there's no culture at all where males spend more time nurturing infants than females.
None.
But there are, that I know of. But there are cultures, and this is Barry Eula did a major study of all cultures about this. He compared two different pygmy groups, one in the eastern part of the range and one in the western part of the range. And one, the men spent almost as much time as the women doing certain childcare tasks. And the other one, the men spent almost no time at all, which is kind of typical. And in that larger context, when you look at ethnographers have samples of cultures that we can go look stuff up, like how many cultures do this, how many cultures do that. You don't find any cultures where males spend more time than females in childcare. But there are cultures where men spend a lot of time with childcare and some where they spend no time, but the females are always doing more than the males. There's various reasons we can think of that makes sense. The fact that women lactate and men don't is probably important. The fact that every single baby that a woman gives birth to is definitely her child, and that's simply not known for males to the same degree. The fact that men often have other roles that are more external to a household in most traditional societies probably matters as well. And that doesn't mean that there aren't people where the men take more care than in a given household.
Right.
I'm talking about the average cultural trait. And for that matter, outside of certain cultures, it's probably something you find is more than an average. There's a pretty distinct difference between males and females.
So then, is the concept of a human universal really based on an average then?
Well, it depends on what the universal is, I think. But yeah, it often is. And the thing is, I guess a sort of a deeper way of thinking about this is a human universal trait, to the extent that we want to use this as a concept, it has to be a few things. It has to be a trait that's kind of distinct to humans. If you pick a person up and let go, they fall to the ground. Every person does that. That's a completely irrelevant universal because it has to do with gravity. It applies to apples and it applies to people. Humans lactate. Well, that applies to all mammals. So, you know, it's not really a human universal. It is in a way, but it's a trivial one. So, you know, what is it that makes humans distinct as a species and that also shows up pretty much in every culture? That counts as a universal. And those things are always going to have to be considered to be trends or averages or observations that almost always are true, but sometimes we'll have exceptions. But what's more interesting about them is there'll be traits, I think, what's interesting about them is there'll often be traits that seem to be widespread, but when you really look at them, they're not. They'll be completely absent in some places, and they're really just the end product of some other underlying, deeper, consistent behaviors that humans carry out. This conversation you and I are having started with this blog post, which I wrote because I had just finished reading The Science of Kissing. It was interesting to me to find out that kissing is not a universal trait. In fact, it's a trait that can be seen to spread across time, and probably if you had enough information, you could probably see it disappear in some areas. But it's the kind of thing that if I told you, well, I found out that Canadians kiss and Americans kiss and Japanese kiss. The typical psychology study does three or four groups in North America plus Japan. Therefore, it's a human universal. But then if we went, well, let's look at 10 other cultures and randomly choose them on the globe and find out, well, actually, only 7 out of 10 do this or something. It turns out that it's not a human universal. Yet, what's going on probably is that something underlying kissing, something that kissing is for, something that kissing happens because of, or something that kissing does, is a human universal, some aspect of intimacy or trust. Because kissing is used in all kinds of contexts in where it occurs. It's, you know, you kiss your child, you kiss your lover, you kiss your, decades ago in our society, you kiss the dead body of a person who was at a wake. These have four very different meanings and very different things associated with them. But they have to do with intimacy or trust or bonding or family ties or blah, 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 all different kinds of things. And maybe the kiss is just serving many purposes, or maybe it's one possible outcome of some underlying things that people typically do.
We have a question from Miguel Picanso. It strikes me as a bit obvious to set yourself up against an easy target, the absolute or universal claim. Why did you then play the paradox card by stating that universals existed, but then proceed to instead describe them in terms of generalizations, commonalities, by ignoring exceptions, etc.?
That gets very much to the whole point of even talking about this, really. Mm-hmm. If we want to not think universals are real or not think that they're important, then all you need to do is describe any universal and then find exceptions. And my counterargument to that would be, okay, let's do that. And when you find serious exceptions, then you have maybe argued that this is not a universal, but sometimes your exceptions are going to be absurd. You have exceptions that are really particularistic or unusual or not relevant to the overall manifestation of this particular, like we talked about before, people who are colorblind or sightless are not really exceptions. So it's not really an argument against something. And that's what I was trying to do in that blog post, was to kind of set up what kinds of exceptions are there that are made. I wasn't really trying to answer the question of what ones are allowable. I don't think it's a paradox. I think it's just a Brown, who wrote the book on human universals, was a cultural anthropologist who was confronted with the idea that biological determinism would result in people being similar in many ways, and all the stuff that Margaret Mead had said about cultures in the Pacific, that where the sex roles were reversed, that can't happen. And, you know, he set out to find proof or exceptions to the idea of there being common patterns across people, and convince himself as a cultural anthropologist that actually there was something to the idea of human universals. There was something there. And that happened roughly in scholarly time with the deconstruction of Margaret Mead and Ruth Benedict's concepts of culture, which were very constructivist. Culture is constructed by people, by culture constructs itself, and then the culture constructs the people. And so you wouldn't expect there to be universals. And their work was heavily criticized and partly discredited. So it was possible to think about these things. So it's still an open question as to whether or not we can describe or find it useful to describe people in generalities, but there are different camps who come to the table with a predisposition of not liking the idea at all or thinking it's obvious and why wouldn't you? You know, and that's kind of what I was trying to get at, was that contrast between approaches that people have.
So the distinction that you're drawing then is really between an extremely common cultural trait versus something that's purely genetic in origin?
I'm not really drawing the distinction as much as what I'm saying is that people will come to the table saying, yeah, there's obviously, you know, natural selection has shaped our genome to cause us to behave in certain typical ways across the species no matter what, versus the idea that our cultures are highly malleable and their constructions. And I'm saying that both of those are falsehoods. because genes would do a pretty lousy job at forming and determining the kind of complex, nuanced behaviors we need to survive as human beings, mainly because we live in a world with all these other human beings, and that makes it really complicated. If there weren't any other human beings, this would be kind of easy. And the idea of constructivism is that anything can happen, and there isn't really any kind of determinism, but there really is a determinism. People will be shaped, I think, to have whatever traits they have because of things in their environment as much as because of genes that are in their bodies. When it comes to behavior and how people think and what people think, it's a very long way from a gene to a neuron firing a certain way. There's too many ways in which that can't actually explain behavior, but it's a very short distance from our society and our culture to how your brain works. We do something weird that other animals don't do. We have a developmental period that's very long and very dangerous. In many parts of the world, most people who die, die when they're kids. It's a period of vulnerability. It's a period when everyone else has to spend a lot of energy on taking care of you. It's not normal. I mean, most other species don't bother with that. We have an extended period of childhood, and that's obviously when children are learning all the things that they learn. And what's interesting is that they all learn it the same way. They all end up doing something very similar as adults, a lot more similar than you would think if anything could happen. So I'm contrasting the genetically determined human universal as being too simplistic and it can't really work to the culturally constructed, there can't be any universals, by saying actually the cultural construction was going to construct the same kind of person every time within certain limits. You know, so I would argue that we have human universals, but that they're determined by the fact that we live in societies with other human beings.
So what you're actually trying to do here is trying to help us think a little bit more like anthropologists.
Yes, but specifically, I think that within anthropology, we do have a contrast between genetic determinism and cultural constructivism. And I think that genetics are part of a highly flexible form of construction of a human being, and cultural influences are highly deterministic, like most people think genes are.
Greg, as usual, thank you for the food for thought.
My pleasure.
And you can read more about human universals and all of the many, many other things that Greg finds interesting, and so do we, at scienceblogs.com/Greg Layden. And we'll be right back with author Cheryl Kirschenbaum after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. You can email your questions for next week's episode to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio, or use our handy question submission box on the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also subscribe to the show in iTunes or listen to past episodes. And while you're there, why not add your review? Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
I'm here with Cheryl Kirschenbaum, research scientist with the Weber Energy Group at the University of Texas at Austin Center for International Energy and Environmental Policy. She co-hosts The Intersection on Discover Blogs with Chris Mooney, with whom she also co-authored Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. She's here to talk about her new book, The Science of Kissing. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Cheryl.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
So how did all this start? The book, not the kissing. We'll get to that.
Well, it's certainly not the topic I ever thought I'd be spending all this time writing a book on. But I try to write a lot of topics that appeal to broad audiences, especially on the blog. And 3 years ago, about a week before Valentine's Day, I did a very short post called The Science of Kissing, just about what's going on in our bodies. And immediately, I just got this overwhelming response from readers and then also from scientists. And not long after that, the American Association for the Advancement of Science invited me to co-organize a symposium for the following year. And at that point, I just thought, what a great subject. Here we have a near universal human behavior that you can put under the scientific lens from all of these different fields and really tell a story. And as I was looking, it hadn't been done before.
I can say with some assurance that the Skeptically Speaking episodes that discuss sex tend to be quite popular.
Well, I'm glad.
But why all the interest in talking about the science of kissing, do you think?
Honestly, the thing that surprised me most was how little had been written and researched on kissing, because we spend a lot of time looking at, you know, particular behaviors in other species, something as like a foraging behavior in a bird. And here we have this behavior that so many of us do that no one was putting under a scientific lens and talking about why we do it. Or if they were, it was kind of from a different angle. And I think we hesitate to study a lot of sexual behaviors, particularly female sexual behaviors, although kissing is obviously both. But almost all the research I was coming across dealt with men, which is kind of interesting. But kissing, you know, in one sense, maybe seems like it's not as serious, so maybe people stayed away from it for that reason. And also, it's so hard to figure out the significance and the emotion behind a kiss, so maybe it's got that complexity to it that it wasn't something we forged into.
Well, you also talk about in the book that it's difficult to provide a scientific explanation for what a kiss is in the first place. Maybe let's define kissing in whatever way we can. The kissing that we mostly think of involves two mouths. Let's start there.
Two mouths. Right. So in the book, I make a distinction between, you know, kissing mouth to mouth and then broadening that definition to kissing-like behaviors that we see in people that didn't traditionally kiss. So the pressing of one's lips to another person, body part, or even an object in some cases.
But that style of kiss, the two-mouth style, that isn't common in every culture, is it?
Kissing mouth-to-mouth was not traditionally practiced in most cultures.
Right.
But decades ago, anthropologists estimated that over 90% of cultures around the world were kissing. And this was before the rise of the Internet. This was before we were all traveling as much as we do now. So I would suspect that number is even higher today, because we also export the behavior through our media, through our films and literature that travels all around the world as we do.
That's interesting to me that it is not something that's just always been there, because you say that it showed up in literature around 1500 BC in India.
Right, India's Vedic Sanskrit texts. That is the first literary evidence we have for kissing. But given there are so many similar behaviors across the animal kingdom, and now scientists have to be so careful when we describe the behaviors of other animals because we can't use words like love, we don't want to anthropomorphize.
Right.
But there are so many kissing-like behaviors where two individuals connect, whether it's out of affection, social grooming, conflict. I would suspect that humans have been also engaged in other kissing-like behaviors for probably as long as we've been around. But also keep in mind, we weren't using mouthwash and toothbrushes up until recently. So for a long time, it was also probably a very different experience.
Oh, that is awful right there.
Well, one of the things I enjoyed most while writing the book is about the science of kissing, but I felt like to tell a complete story, I also had to explore the history and the cultural component of the behavior, because that plays an equal role. And I started reading all of these really interesting travel logs from explorers in the 1800s, traveling from Europe to different parts of Africa and Finland and places where people didn't kiss mouth to mouth. And it was so fascinating to me how many similar behaviors were described, and also the experiences. Like, there's this one terrific story where a young explorer goes to Africa and he falls in love with this king's daughter, and he finally summons up the courage to give her a kiss. And when he does, she just runs screaming from the room, and then he soon realizes that she mistakenly thought he was planning to eat her, because why else was he going to, you know, putting his lips upon her face? It's just not something that was as familiar in many places as it is today.
So there's actually a lot of myth around kissing in literature, actually. And you were talking about people who specifically didn't like kissing. And I'm speaking about the Catholic Church.
Well, that was a really, really interesting situation, because we had the apostles who said things like, greet thy neighbor with a holy kiss. And then you had a lot of priests kind of wringing their hands going, ooh, we don't want our congregation kissing, because that can be a lustful behavior that will lead to carnal sin. How do we come to terms with this? There were a lot of different congregations that became separated by sex because they wanted to avoid people kissing the opposite sex in church. And so a lot of other traditions arose, like there was kissing the pax. People would kiss this disc, but then they ran into trouble there too, because an eligible young woman would kiss the pax, and then all of these young men would run up to kiss it right after her, right where she put her lips, and then the priests weren't happy about that either.
So is it mainly Europeans that were interested in mouth-to-mouth kissing?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, from India, and actually very famously from the Kama Sutra, there is an entire chapter on kissing a lover, where and how and ways to kiss a lover. And so there was definitely mouth-to-mouth kissing going on in many parts of the world. And I think for many of these places, we also don't have that literary evidence of what was taking place. But Europeans definitely were avid mouth kissers, and they were very good about popularizing the practice as they traveled. I mean, the first big example, I think, are the Romans, who were very avid. and colorful open mouth kiss. There's some great poetry both celebrating the kiss and then also sort of making fun of people who have to suffer through all these social kisses, because it's not just about romantic kissing. It's a lot of social greetings. We see in a lot of the ancient literature and a lot of the popular literature that survived, not just romantic kissing, but kissing that was really reflective of social status. For example, in Homer, in Greece, Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, we see kissing in supplication. We see kissing as a reflection of social status, but we don't see romantic kissing, even though these are stories where clearly romantic kissing could have taken place between Paris and Helen, between Odysseus and Penelope. But then by Roman times, we see lots of poetry about kissing, and it was really through the military conquests of the Romans that they began to spread the practice. That's kind of the first early evidence we have of the kiss being spread as people from Europe started traveling to other parts of the world.
You know, after I read your book, I started to think about the fact that in a lot of these texts, I had missed the fact that kissing was missing.
I actually did too. I was, aside from a biology major in college, I was also a classics major, so I must have read both the Iliad and Odyssey like three separate times. And it didn't occur to me, but then I went back in. I worked with Donald Leitner, who is a classicist and he's actually studied a lot of kissing history through literature in Greece and Rome. And he was the one who kind of first pointed me to this. And I have to just say, you know, really, if it weren't for so many wonderful professors in science and classics and history working with me as allies throughout the process of this book, I could not have even come close to what I was able to do. But it was going back and looking at these, for example, the Odyssey, and here's Odysseus returning home after all this time, I think 20 years away from Penelope, and we see his slaves kissing his hands and being so excited that he's back, but when he reunites with his wife, there isn't that moment. There's not a kiss the way that we would expect one to be in any kind of romantic film or book that comes out today.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm talking about the rise of the kiss with Cheryl Kirshenbaum, author of The Science of Kissing. So let's move ahead in time. What about current cultures?
Well, as I was saying a little bit earlier, I expect it is an almost near universal practice. There are very few places in the world that haven't been exposed to kissing as we recognize it today, but it takes a variety of forms. And so in parts of Europe and South America, Latin America, there's, for example, a lot more social kissing, a lot more kissing as a greeting. But it really varies by not just region, but, well, by neighborhood in terms of what people expect to do in different parts of the world. And then, of course, in some places, mouth-to-mouth kissing might be practiced, but it's not as socially acceptable in public. So many parts of the Middle East, for example, people are kissing, but behind closed doors.
We have a question from Kylie Sturgis. Is there any culture that does not see kissing as an acceptable behavior?
Well, that's a great question, Kylie. I looked and looked and looked, but I did not find a specific culture that just says, ooh, kissing is gross. I mean, I definitely did in the 1800s, but it's so hard to generalize at this point because people are traveling everywhere, and even if something isn't acceptable in one particular family or group, it's something that is present within that culture.
Well, I did find it interesting. You did mention that Germans were sort of averse to public displays of affection, but that they also have 30 words for kissing.
Including one that means the kisses for the kisses that haven't taken place.
That's brilliant. We have a question from Troy L. Why do we call kissing with tongues French kissing? How did they feel about that in France?
It's an interesting story. So no one's exactly sure why it's called French kissing. But what I found the most evidence for is that as Europeans were traveling to different parts of Europe, some of the men were finding that the women in France were a little more open in terms of being very affectionate. And so there became this saying that said, when in France, get the girls to kiss you. And then eventually that kind of evolved into, when you're in France, get a French kiss. And then we began thinking of that open mouth kiss as a French kiss. But in France, they don't actually call it the French kiss. They call it the soul kiss, or, you know, just the open mouth kiss, the tongue kiss.
And a question from Dale Gamble. Is there a scientific explanation for why kissing styles vary so widely among individuals, even in a culture that shares a basic method of kissing?
It's this great example of a behavior that is nature and nurture. We have this instinctive drive to kiss, and there are so many reasons for that. But it's also very much a part of our culture and a learned experience. So I think that a specific behavior is also so much shaped by the relationships we have, who we meet, how comfortable we are with our sexuality, so many case-by-case factors that play into what gets expressed as a behavior.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm talking with Cheryl Kirshenbaum, author of The Science of Kissing. So physiologically, can you explain what happens to our bodies when we kiss?
Sure, and I'm going to assume this is a romantic kiss. Well, after we figure out which direction we're tilting our head, actually two-thirds of us tilt our head to the right, which interestingly isn't correlated with right-handedness, but this was published in the journal Nature by a scientist who went around and looked at couples kissing in airports and parks and beaches, and honestly, to me, it sounds a little bit voyeuristic because he kind of just stood back and took notes as he watched people making out. But he cataloged how people were tilting their head and came up with this two-thirds statistic, and he expects that this might have to do with what direction we're tilting our head in the womb. But once we get past the tilting the head part, so assuming it's a good kiss, our pupils dilate, which might be part of the reason that we close our eyes. Our cheeks flush, our breathing can deepen and become irregular. So much is going on. We're actually engaging all of our senses. So all of a sudden we've had this visual information about someone else, but now we're sampling their scent, we're sampling their taste, we're sampling their touch. And all of these factors play a role and send signals to our brains to help us decide what to do next. If we're comfortable, do we want to pursue a deeper relationship? So there are a lot of neurotransmitters and hormones involved in a positive good match, and when there's real chemistry there. I mean, there's a reason it's called chemistry, right? The hormone oxytocin, also known popularly as the love hormone, can increase, it can rise in our bodies, and that's responsible for feelings of attachment, starting and maintaining a social bond. And it's really, really important in both new relationships and long-term relationships. There's also a neurotransmitter known as dopamine, and what dopamine does is it's responsible for those feelings of craving, that desire, that can't wait to be with this person kind of feeling. It's also the neurotransmitter that, coincidentally, is stimulated from a line of cocaine. It's that same pleasure center in the brain that gets going. And so kisses are addictive. It's a really good feeling, and dopamine is also involved in novel experiences. So for a first kiss, you can get that level of dopamine, that satisfying and craving sensation, spiking to really high heights. There's also serotonin, a neurotransmitter that is associated with obsessive compulsive thoughts that, you know, can't stop thinking about someone that takes over, and just you feel obsessed with this partner that you're with. And all of a sudden, as I'm reading about all these different neurotransmitters and hormones, it dawns on me that, wow, this is pretty neat, because all of the so-called symptoms that we associate with falling in love, well, they actually have a chemical basis. And that's pretty cool. I don't think it takes the romance out or the magic out, but it's really neat to start thinking about how our bodies work and why we feel the way that we do. And then epinephrine starts getting our heart rate going, and so many other things are ebbing and flowing throughout our bodies. But if all the right hormones and neurotransmitters get going, then we're getting a message that this is something to maybe take to the next level. And if things maybe aren't going so well, I think it's really important to trust our bodies and to really think, well, maybe this is a sign that I should be looking elsewhere.
You also mentioned that there's a disproportionate neural space associated with our lips. So what does that mean?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm kind of a neuroscience geek, and a lot of the research as I was reading wound up being related to neuroscience, and then I was fortunate enough to end up working closely on an experiment later in the book with David Popple, who is a neuroscientist at New York University and absolutely amazing to volunteer his time and his lab and his magnetoencephalography machine to furthering kissing research that found its way into the book. But one of the things that we ended up talking about and that I really wanted to write about was the amount of space in our brain that's associated with sensitivity to our lips. There's something called the somatosensory homunculus, and what it would look like, and I have this great image of a statue in the book. It's a male statue because, as I was saying before, females kind of get ignored, but
right.
It would probably look sort of similar for both genders, and it is proportioned where the size of that part of the body is corresponding to the amount of neural space that's associated with the sensory of that region. So, for example, the hands are quite large because our hands are so important for heat, cold, touch. We gather so much information from our hands that we need a lot of space in our brain to do that. Well, the lips are absolutely enormous, as is the tongue. And when you think about it, you know, our lips are packed with sensitive nerve endings. And so even a light brush across our lips stimulates a huge portion of our brain to sort of respond to that experience. I mean, it's also associated with heat and cold, with pain, with, you know, a lot of other things. But the point is that our lists provide a lot of information about the world. We're not always thinking of them that way, but they really do. And so it's just kind of neat when you're thinking about it from a kissing behavior perspective. Well, we're using our lips to tell us so much about, well, namely compatibility with another person when we connect that way.
And how about mirror neurons? Your book taught me so much. So there might be kind of an automatic kissing response?
Mirror neurons are a very controversial topic in neuroscience. But it's something that V.S. Ramachandran out at UC San Diego talks about a lot. And the reason I started thinking about it initially in terms of kissing was he was talking about mirror neurons with his work on phantom limbs, which he became very famous for and he talks about a lot. And he did a lot of research on, you know, why people feel these sensations in their limbs if their limbs are missing. And he started talking about how this idea of mirror neurons works. And what it is if you watch someone else experiencing something, the same neurons in your brain would be firing as if it were happening to you yourself. So if you see someone getting pricked by a pin, well, there's a response in your brain as if it was happening to you. And this is very interesting in a behavior like kissing, because are we responding to someone else kissing us as if we were making the movement? I mean, are we more likely to respond to a kiss because we're watching someone else about to kiss us? I mean, it might even work with pornography. Like, why do people enjoy watching pornography so much if they're not engaged in that sexual act?
Right.
Well, they're experiencing some kind of pleasure from it. And is that mirror neuron response in the brain? I mean, it's possible. There's been interesting research that sort of suggests, yes, they exist, no, they don't exist. But I think in terms of kissing, it just opens a lot of questions. And there has been some research in macaques, not with kissing, but with macaques watching scientists or research staff making kissing like gestures with their mouth, and actually the researchers found that there were similar neurons firing in the macaques' brains that would stimulate lip movement as the researchers who were doing it themselves.
Now, even a bad kiss has its own kind of effect.
Well, yeah, kissing does not always go well, and if the kiss isn't quite right, you might get a rise in a hormone called cortisol. And that's popularly called the stress hormone. And the stress hormone, cortisol, and kissing do not mix. So you won't have all of these positive things going on in your body and your brain and making you feel good. Instead, you might feel immediately like, oh, something's off. What is it? And it could be as simple as just you feel pressured, the environment isn't right, the timing is bad. I mean, it could be very immediate circumstances, but it could also have to be with maybe a poorly suited match, because it turns out that when we're kissing someone, we're consciously at work assessing what's going on, but there's a lot happening at the subconscious level. And one of the most interesting examples of this has to do with our very genetics, which is kind of neat. It turns out Klaus Wedekind, a biologist, discovered that women are most attracted to the scents of men with a very distinct set of genes for their immune systems than their own. And so the outcome of that would be, well, if a woman and a man got together and had a child with a very diverse set of genes for immune systems, their child would probably be healthier, more likely to survive and pass on their genes down the line. So there is this evolutionary advantage to that. But what's really surprising is that there seems to be this kind of scent attraction that is reflective of what this set of genes is. It's called the major histocompatibility complex, or the MHC. But most fascinating to me, because it relates to so many of my girlfriends, is that women who are on the birth control pill actually have the opposite response and seem to be most attracted to the men with this MHC most similar to their own. So all of a sudden, our attraction to other people has shifted. It opens up a lot of questions about, well, what are these hormones that we're taking doing to these signals that we've evolved
Absolutely.
For a very long time to have? And how is that changing attraction? And what does that mean for a relationship that starts under one set of circumstances, and then if a couple gets married and, you know, a woman goes off the pill, well, might that account for a loss of attraction, maybe higher divorce rates in young couples? Who knows?
That part kind of disturbed me, because you're right. There's a lot of other questions that raises.
And that wasn't the only study I found that. There was a great little anecdote I put in after the first chapter about this fascinating study involving strippers. But there were actually researchers that looked at the tips that strippers made throughout the month. And it turned out when these women were ovulating, they were earning a lot more. When they had their period, they were earning a lot less. And then there was a median that they tended to earn on the weeks between. this was for women who weren't on the birth control. Those on the birth control, you know, they were earning about the same throughout. So are there all these separate cues and signals that we're responding to but not aware of that all of a sudden we're completely offsetting by taking contraception, perhaps?
And we have a question from Al Morrison. Do we know if the kissing of other erogenous areas produces the same neurochemical changes as mouth kissing?
Interesting question. I'd like to know that, too. The research to date on kissing itself and the responses in the body is in its infancy. There have been some great studies about how these different hormones, for example, are changing. There's a wonderful study out of Lafayette with Carrie Wilson and Wendy Hill, who are two researchers there. And they actually had couples come into a health facility and make out, and then before and after they would measure their saliva and blood concentrations of different chemicals. And it wasn't quite working because it turned out the health facility itself was a little bit stressful, and this idea that they were going to be poked with needles was kind of changing the experience.
For
I mean, it was kind of hilarious. But no, there hasn't actually been too much research on other kinds of kissing and our body's responses to them. And I mean, one of the things that I did in the book towards the end is I said, well, here are the things we know, and then here are a bunch of other studies that I think would be really interesting to pursue, and that's certainly part of that group. So, I mean, it's a great question, and I'd love to see someone pursue that.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm talking with Cheryl Kirschenbaum, author of The Science of Kissing. So you mentioned that you also did your own research into the brain's response to watching people kiss.
Well, I just thought to myself, if I'm writing this science book, I mean, this is my first solo project, if I'm going to do this, well, why not take readers into a laboratory? I'm so used to being in this academic bubble. I'm at my fourth university now working and teaching that I just thought, you know, most people don't experience that. So why not tell that story, talk about what it's like to set up an experiment, talk about what it's like to be in a laboratory, get your brain scanned in a brain scanning machine, and then what the results are like and how to talk about them and what they mean and don't mean and gender stereotypes and all these different factors. And so, yeah, in this experiment, as I was saying before, New York University, wonderful neuroscientist named David Poppel and his team, who were just unbelievably kind and wonderful to donate their time, energy, and I think we're submitting the manuscript actually for the research next week. So I'm pretty excited because hopefully it will wind up in an open access journal that readers can actually go and read the actual, you know, academic paper that goes along with the book very soon. But what we did is I was looking at this mountain of literature that I had collected that was on kissing and related research that I used to inform most of the book, and I thought, well, what would the next step be? And I was interested, as I said, I'm a big neuroscience geek. I was interested in neuroscience, and I was interested in male and female responses because there is this huge gender divide in how people's preferences and attitudes turn out on kissing. But also men are they're a lot more visual in terms of arousal and other things. And I just thought, would we see a different response between men and women watching kissing? It had to be watching kissing because in terms of using an MEG machine, this magnetoencephalography machine, which measures magnetic current, we couldn't jam two people's heads into this weird device that kind of looks like a toilet bowl where you stick your head and have them make out, because first they didn't fit, and secondly, you can't move in the machine, so it posed, you know, these immediate problems. So we showed them pictures of different couples kissing, tried to standardize them in some way, you know, black and white cropped around the head, and made some look more erotic, some look just friendly, and some look kind of sweet, like a committed relationship. Would we see differences in these people's brains watching the kisses? And how might that look? And so we ended up setting the whole thing up, and I did a whole survey on my blog encouraging people to give me their impressions of photos of kisses, which helped me choose the kisses to use in the actual experiment. But we found out it wasn't at all along gender lines as I expected. What we found was completely different, and there was a earlier and stronger response watching same-sex couples kissing. I wanted to include same and opposite sex kissing because I feel like that's far more reflective of different kinds of people, and I was sick of reading about just heterosexual science research. But I didn't think that that would really change the response. I just wanted to add more variety, and in fact, watching same-sex pairs kiss evoked this earlier and stronger response. But then I was left with this dilemma because, okay, so we've seen something interesting, but I don't want this misinterpreted by the media. I know what the media does to science stories. They always try to sex it up. They always try to make it bigger and draw conclusions. And especially with a topic like same and opposite sex kissing, I'm going, well, what am I going to say and how will that be spun? So I think it's really important to emphasize that this was probably something in neuroscience that's called the frequency effect. In studies looking at brain response to images and language, it turns out there's often a stronger response to words and images that we encounter less frequently. And so, for example, in a language test, if someone were to hear the word table, it would usually evoke a smaller response than a word like ibex, which we hear very infrequently. And on a day-to-day basis, people are probably encountering more opposite-sex kissing than same-sex kissing just in their daily routine. And so there would be a lot of ways to test this with follow-up studies. But it was also kind of neat to just sort of see how that turned out. And I should also mention that the people we put through the machine were from many different parts of the world and also both homosexual and heterosexual subjects.
Well, we have a related question from Cassie. I just saw that you tweeted a link about an fMRI machine that can scan the brains of two people at the same time. If you had unlimited access to one of those, what questions would you want to try to answer?
That is such a great question, and I cannot tell you how many people also sent me that link throughout the entire day who probably had read my book or knew I was involved in this experiment, including one of the lab members of the group that actually helped me with the research. So I don't know the specifics of how that MRI machine works. I would assume that both people probably still have to stay very still, so it would probably be difficult to get them to actually kiss on the machine, although I'm not 100% sure. But just being in that close proximity to someone else, even if they can see each other, is going to have an influence on how they feel, whether they're comforted. There's been a lot of research looking at pain response based on who is in the room with the person using electric shock. It actually sounds kind of evil. people tend to feel, for example, less pain, be less uncomfortable if they're with someone that they trust. So in a machine like that, you could feasibly even start doing things like having participants hold hands and seeing how certain hormones are changing because they're with someone that they're very comfortable with, someone that they love, or a partner compared to different strangers. It opens the door to so many possibilities that I'm pretty excited to see what they do with it.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm talking with Cheryl Kirschenbaum, author of The Science of Kissing, about how your brain and body responds to the locking of the lips. And we'll be right back with more of that after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're joined by science writer Jessica Wapner. We'll examine the intersection between ethics, economics, and drug development, and what it means for the future of pharmaceutical research. And we sit down with author, comedian, and futurist Mark Stevenson to discuss his new book, An Optimist's Tour of the Future, about the cutting-edge science that's going to sustain and entertain the human species. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 Mountain Time, live at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm here with Cheryl Kirschenbaum, science blogger and co-author of Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. We've been discussing her new book, The Science of Kissing. So let's look at kissing from an evolutionary perspective. Now, you've found some interesting results around gendered perspectives on kissing.
Yes, that surprised me and annoyed me. But when I thought about it a little more and talked to the people involved in the research, it made a lot more sense. At the State University of New York at Albany, an evolutionary psychologist, Gordon Gallup, and his team did a survey of well over 1,000 people who happened to be students. He was interested in their kissing attitudes and preferences. And this very distinct gender divide emerged. And so over and over and over, when asking men about the kissing experience, they would say something like, oh, you know, kissing is nice. It's a means to an end. I'm kissing her kind of thinking about what she might be like in bed, or kissing her hoping it leads to swapping other bodily fluids later. You know, answers like that. And
right.
Women tended to put a lot more emphasis on the act of kissing itself. So a woman would generally say something like, I'm kissing him to understand how he feels about me or where we're headed. You know, really spending the time to enjoy the experience itself and figure out what that said about their connection. But it kind of irritated me because I am not someone who is fond of gender stereotypes. And so initially my thought was, well, wait a second. You know, he's asking a very select group of the population. He's asking college co-eds who are probably in this, like, very
it's a gender binary right there.
Yeah.
Right.
And so I just thought to myself, well, you know, it's not a scientific poll, but I'm going to ask my own friends and acquaintances who are much more diverse, varied in age, varied in marital status, gay, straight, and everything in between. And to my surprise, they started falling exactly along the same line. So I called up Gordon Gallup, and we talked a lot about reproductive strategies. And the truth is, a woman has to invest a lot more in choosing a mate in terms of, you know, if this person is going to stick around, take care of her, take care of a child, really assess if they're a good partnership, whereas a man has a lot more opportunity. You know, women, we're born with really all of our eggs in two baskets, our ovaries. We have about, on average, 400 opportunities for a few days a month to get pregnant, whereas men are producing sperm really throughout most of their lives into their 90s, you know? And so it's important for women to really be spending the time to figure out if they should be with someone. And actually, we're much more sensitive to taste, we're much more sensitive to scent, and we use these as clues to figure out if this is the right person to be with. And from that perspective, biologically, it does make more sense that women would be much more focused on the kiss itself.
So women have a vested interest in utilizing any way possible to narrow down the pool then of available fathers to find the best prospect.
Yeah, and to find someone who, you know, is well suited both genetically and probably behaviorally, and also maybe taking the time to know who they are and spending the time to get to know them, making them comfortable in the experience.
Well, I just want to clarify, though, we're not necessarily saying that, you know, good kisser equals good father, because my anecdotal evidence would disagree with that.
No. I mean, it's different for everyone, and certainly
right.
Kissing is something I think that a couple can find their sync over time. It's not like a bad kiss blows it every time. But it's also sort of this important signal, I think, in relationships that happens very early on, where you know if you feel like you have chemistry with someone, and it's more than a kiss itself, but a kiss is the ultimate way to get in someone's personal space, to have that time together. It's really nature's ultimate litmus test of a relationship.
Well, you mentioned four theories as to how and I guess why kissing could have developed.
I found a lot more, but I really wanted to stick to the primary literature. You have no idea how much misinformation is circulating on kissing, and not just on the internet. I mean, in books that are supposed to be about kissing, there are just these ridiculous factoids that have absolutely no basis. So, yeah, I stuck to these four theories that I found in the literature. Two of them are related. The two that are related are the process of nursing and also premastication, which is the pre-chewing of food for another individual, which might sound a little gross, but before we had baby food, it was a very easy way to feed and nourish a growing toddler and infant. And so those processes are involved or are associated with lip stimulation, tongue stimulation, and also feelings of security, comfort, an individual's first sensation of being loved. And even though later in life romantic kissing occurs under very different circumstances, those neural pathways are probably laid down very early that are, you know, connecting this lip stimulation with these associated feelings in our bodies. And so kissing probably stimulates some of the same emotional responses because of these early experiences we have in our, you know, our youngest memories. Another one is this idea of social kiss, kissing on the cheek. And keep in mind, these theories are not mutually exclusive, and kissing also probably arose and disappeared around the world for various reasons throughout history, independently of each other. But another theory has to do with the social kiss on the cheeks. And for a long time, you know, humans didn't have light bulbs. We depended a lot more on our noses for recognition of family and friends. And there was a sniff greeting. We have powerful scent glands around our faces. And so there was a sniff on either cheek. And over time, at some point, this probably became accompanied by a brush of the lips and eventually the cheek kissing that we see in many different parts of the world today. And so scent played a big role in our ancestors' lives, and it still does today. I mean, even when we go into an unfamiliar home, we're often sort of consciously or subconsciously sampling the scent of what it's like, and that's something we also do with people. But the most intriguing theory about why we're attracted to another person's lips that was one of the most interesting parts of the research for this book. I was talking to V.S. Ramachandran again, who I mentioned earlier when I was talking about mirror neurons, but Ramachandran and I were discussing, you know, why are lips so attractive? Well, humans are very, very primed to notice the color red, and that may have evolved when our ancestors needed to locate ripe fruit among the brush, and those who could detect the color red best probably were a little better at finding food, surviving long enough to pass along their genes, and over time, the signal for red becoming associated with some kind of food reward became hardwired in our brains. And also, after we developed the ability to detect color at some point, our ancestors also started developing red on their bodies in other areas usually associated with sex. So we still see that in many primates today, this plump, rosy bottom on certain, you know, females when they're in heat, when they're ready to reproduce, when they're in estrus, I should say. But our ancestors at some point stood upright and sexual signals shifted. And so we very popularly hear how, you know, the buttocks kind of moved up and that's why our breasts look the way they do.
Right.
But also other signals shifted. And so this rosy posterior eventually was co-opted, it's called, and started showing up on our faces and our red, rosy lips. So Desmond Morris, zoologist Desmond Morris, calls our lips, in fact, a genital echo. He says they have the shape and the texture and the color of our a female's genital region. And for that reason, they are so attractive, particularly to the opposite sex, and also enhanced, not just in modern culture, but for thousands of years, women have enhanced the color of their lips through dyes or strong wines. They've tinted them to make them look even redder, even rosier, because it has that effect where it's an attractant to men. And he tested this. He ended up having some male subjects go through a whole bunch of photographs of women wearing various shades of lipstick. And lo and behold, the women photographed with the brightest colors were over and over described as being the most alluring.
But there is no real consensus between anthropologists as to, you know, which theory would be the correct one or whether kissing is genetic or cultural, correct?
Right, right. Well, I mean, I think, first of all, like, none of these theories are mutually exclusive, as I was saying before. I think many could go hand in hand. But no, I mean, we don't have a time machine to go back and figure out who is doing what when. So obviously, I mean, there's a lot involved in this.
How about, you know, regardless of evolutionary benefits, kissing is fun.
Kissing is fun. And where it has arisen in cultures, it's something that tends to stick around. And just going back to the history, I kept finding these instances of kings and rulers trying to suppress the behavior and sort of police the lips of their subjects, and it never works. No matter what they tried to do to outlaw kissing, it's a popular activity, and they weren't able to do it.
I hear it's free. Mostly. Most times. And you actually, at the end of the book, you provide some helpful suggestions on how we can improve our performance. Since we're pretty much out of time, but what would you say is the most important lesson that science has taught us about becoming a better kisser?
If there's a lot riding on a kiss, if it's not just someone you meet at a party, but someone that you really longed for a while and that you want to pursue a deeper connection with, trying to forge a bond before your lips even meet can really make the likelihood of that situation going well even better. Laying down sort of this hormonal basis, getting oxytocin and dopamine going before your lips connect might make it all the more satisfying for both people later on. And so I think there's a lot of power to that. And then also, it's not necessarily toward boosting the likelihood that it'll go well, but just trusting yourself and how you feel and not second-guessing whether it's an awesome experience or whether it's not so good. Your body has evolved these natural signals to let you know if things are going well. And also, once you find someone, to keep kissing often. It's a really great way to maintain your relationship and spend the time to reconnect over time.
So says science. Thanks for being here, Cheryl.
Thank you so much for having me on. This was fun.
And you can find Cheryl's work, including The Science of Kissing, at CherylKirschenbaum.com, and that link will also be on our website at SkepticallySpeaking.com. From there, follow the links to our Facebook page, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can listen to archived episodes, subscribe to the show, or write a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on! The skeptics await your letter. You call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever.
a ray shell, gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking, our mind reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.